Please stand, please. We're glad to have you with us. You may be seated. The students are here with a program by the State Bar and the Supreme Court. The program is called Court with Class, and it is a national award-winning program. We invite high school students from around the state to come join us for an oral argument, and if they come, they've been given the briefs in the case that we hear, and they may engage in other activities relating to the case. After oral argument, the students will meet with a justice of this court to talk about the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. Everyone, student and not, invited to come and listen to the presentation after this case. Now we've met you, let's introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice with whom the classes will meet at noon. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we'll call our second case for today, 03-0173. Dawn Sukala. How do you pronounce it? Sukala?
Sukala.
Versus Heritage Mutual Insurance Company. Representing Heritage Mutual is Arthur Simpson. You have 13 minutes. Nadine Davey, representing Western National Mutual Insurance Company, has 12 minutes, making a total of 25. Dana Weiss has 30 minutes. And in rebuttal, 2 for Arthur Simpson and 3 for Ms. Davey. Right? Okay. Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Judge. Arthur Simpson appearing for defendant, respondent, petitioner, Heritage Mutual Insurance Company, which is now known as Acuity. And forgive me, it took me several years to learn the name Acuity, and now I'm going to have to lapse back to Heritage. So if I skip back and forth in the oral argument, that's why I'm doing that, just so you're aware of it. And that's the reason I point that out. What I'd like to do this morning very quickly is I want to cover three areas. One, a very quick layout of the pertinent facts with respect to this matter. Two, I want to present a quick summary of the 4 points that I believe are important for the court to consider. And finally, very briefly, to elaborate on those points. Mr. Sukala was involved in an accident in 1996. He received roughly $1 million in compensation from various sources over a period of years, largely at the beginning of that time frame. He initially filed an action challenging the reducing clause under the underinsured motorist coverage of the business policy issued by Heritage and his personal policy issued by a company known as Western National. He was unsuccessful in the trial court. He then went to the Court of Appeals, at which time the decision we now refer to as Sukala 1 was issued. At that time, there were issues concerning the developing concept in the law at that point of contextual ambiguity. The Dauhauer decision, in which that concept had been born but certainly not brought to full fruition, had been issued at that point. The plaintiffs and the parties agreed at the Court of Appeals to argue the issues of ambiguity of the policy. The decision speaks in several paragraphs of things such as the declarations page, what it looks like, the type of print on it, the type of analysis that we see when an insurance policy is fly-specked to see whether it should be overturned on the contextual ambiguity basis. The court ultimately decided in Sukala 1, after opportunity for the Sukalas to present whatever argument they wanted, be it new legal argument or factual argument, that the trial court decision should be affirmed and the reducing clause upheld. Mr. Weiss' client then petitioned the State Supreme Court for review. That petition was denied. 8 months later, a petition was granted in the Schmitz case, and I believe that was early 2002. the Schmidt decision was issued. At that point, the court further defined the context of contextual ambiguity in overturning or revising an insurance policy and what's become one of the buzzwords of litigation in the last 3 years, crystal clarity was born.
Okay, easy.
Sorry.
Seemed a good idea at the time.
At any rate, at one point in the Schmidt's decision, there was a question raised, the comment at the end of the Schmidt's decision about Sukala 1 was, I believe, a comment focused on the fact that the Sukala court had an ending sentence in their opinion that said that this court took in Schmidt's to reflect that there wasn't consideration of the entire policy, but more focused just on the UIM issue in terms of ambiguity in Sukala. And there was one sentence in there that the court took some criticism of in the Schmidt's decision. That triggered the Sukalas to start what's now become Sukala 2 that brings us here today. They went to the trial court in Portage County. The trial judge there looked at the matter. He said, I don't think, he said, he had two basic comments that he relied upon. One, the Sukalas, the Schmidt petition was granted roughly 8 months after the Sukala petition was denied. The trial judge looked at this as a situation where the law is simply developing. The judge also, and we quote in our brief, basically said, I don't see that this Schmidt's decision overrules Sukala. If the court had wanted to do that, they certainly had the power and the ability to do so. They did not. What we have is a passing comment on that decision, and that's not enough to grant the extraordinary relief under the 806.07 standard to have a do-over here. The matter was then sent to the Court of Appeals. In the interim, the Folkman case was decided by this court, and I think there also have been numerous decisions from the Court of Appeals on the context of contextual ambiguity and crystal clarity, and I think it's fair to say that that standard has been narrowed somewhat since the Schmidt decision was issued, both by Folkman and the Court of Appeals decisions. The Court of Appeals conducted an analysis of Judge Fleischhauer's decision. They ruled 2-1 to reverse, and that's what brings us here. Our petition for review was granted to discuss what was done there. I wanted to show, that's my outline of the facts. In terms of the four things I think we need to focus on, the number one thing that came to me when I reviewed this Court of Appeals decision relates to the standard of review. This has always been an abuse of discretion standard. Whether a decision of, whether we go to the Mullen case or the Brown case, whatever has happened in the past, the trial court decision has always been affirmed because there's been a failure to show abuse of discretion, and that's the standard.
This is just a correction. Erroneous exercise of discretion. We don't use abuse anymore.
Exercise of discretion. Right. Excuse me. All right. It's an exercise of decision issue. And I think that's the first point that's very important here. The Court of Appeals decision mentions exercise of discretion as a standard, but as my old Latin teacher would love me for saying, what we have here is a de facto de novo review by the Court of Appeals. In other words, they did not, in fact, tell us what Judge Fleischhauer did wrong. There are three steps that he needs to, three things that set forth an appropriate exercise of discretion: the proper legal standard, the relevant facts of the case, and a logical reasoning process. Those are, as outlined in our brief, were present. I think the real flaw in the Court of Appeals decision, because everyone agrees that this is a discretionary standard case. No one's arguing that point. And I guess the question I have to ask is, after reading the Court of Appeals decision, where did the trial court err?
Counsel, isn't their decision saying essentially that it really boils down to fairness, and we disagree with the, or look at paragraph 12 of the opinion, the crux of our inquiry is whether fairness mandates opening the judgment.
Well, that proves great minds think alike, because that's what I have in bold on the first page of my notes about this issue.
Thank you. That's quite a compliment.
I think that But I think you're right. That's really the heart of the problem, is this was a discretion standard, and discretion doesn't mean you say, well, is it fair or isn't it fair? And fairness opens a can of worms, which is why I referred to Heritage Acuity's experiences in trying to get a published opinion on the reducing clause. The bottom line is that there are different fairness aspects that go into a discretionary review court, such as what we have here, in terms of what's going to be handled and what's not going to be handled and how it's going to be handled. That's really the second issue I wanted to talk about with respect to this matter, and that is the Sukalas had their day in court. They had their opportunity during this 10-year chain where the UIM litigation has been going twixt and tween to talk to the court and present whatever issues they wanted, whatever arguments they wanted. Mr. Weiss did a fine job. He did what he could with the case, and they didn't win. That doesn't mean that you get another shot or a do-over when the law changes at some point. What happened to the Sukalas is inherent in the nature of two things in our appellate system. What happened to the Sukalas and Heritage during the course of all this? The number one issue is whether you publish or you don't publish a decision. For example, had the opinion we refer to in our brief been published that would support Heritage's position that this reducing clause is fine, I doubt we would be here. But that's the nature of a system where you're going to publish or not publish, and we're not asking for mercy or begging that that's something that should change the way this case is handled. The second issue here, the appellate issue that applies, is the nature of discretionary review. This is a discretionary review court. And I can't underline that enough. You're going to grant some, you're not going to grant some. And that's the nature of the business, and only under some very limited circumstances, such as the Mullen case, which I'll talk about in just a moment, should we be tampering with that and having redos of cases. And I think that really in the end, that to me is a central policy point here. If you're going to have a discretionary review court, if you're going to have published and unpublished decisions, these things are going to happen to various litigants, and they're going to feel like they've been fouled or this isn't right. But that's a policy decision that's been made, that this is the way our appellate courts are going to proceed, and that I don't believe they should be entitled to redo or relitigate under this set of circumstances. That brings me to my third point that I want to talk about, which is the case law. I really think if you want to look at a couple of cases that frame this issue, the Brown case, which is the Court of Appeals decision, where the trial court was affirmed, getting back to my first issue, as properly exercising discretion, and the Mullen case, where again the trial court was affirmed as properly exercising discretion. In the Mullen case, what had happened is that the Mullens, let me get my timing right here, because there's some confusion in the Court of Appeals opinion in Sukala 2, I think, on that point. What happened in the Mullen court was that the plaintiffs won at the trial court level initially. At the Court of Appeals level, the insurance carrier prevailed, and that became Mullen 1. A petition for review was denied on the issue that the plaintiff raised. 8 months earlier, the petition had been granted in the Nicholson case. And that petition was actually pending at the same time the petition was denied with respect to Mullen. Ultimately, the Supreme Court in Nicholson not only granted the relief that was being sought, but also specifically overruled Mullen. In our case, I don't think we have anything close to overruling, and we have a petition 8 months after the fact. I think you compare those cases and analyze them. Certainly, we fall much more in the Brown realm here than we do anywhere in the Mullen area. Final comment I wanted to have was just a general policy comment, and the dissent referred to this in Sukala too, the concept of fairness and the slippery slope. This is an issue that has a lot of importance, not just because there's an insurance company that's involved here. What if the shoe were on the other foot? Suppose the Schmitz decision had come out and the Sukalas had been awarded $500,000 on a contextual ambiguity situation, and then the Folkman decision comes out. And all of a sudden, could Acuity then turn around and knock on Mr. Weiss' client's door and say, you know, something, the law's changed here. I think we're entitled to our $500,000 back. That's just one potential issue that this kind of a situation raises. It really undermines a very important concept, which is certainty in the law. We spend thousands of hours, we spend thousands and ten thousands of dollars, and we sometimes get the privilege of coming before you folks to present a case. What we're asking for is a decision with some finality. That applies at the trial court level, it applies at the court of appeals level, it applies at the Supreme Court level. Finality is an important concept.
Do you think Sekula 1 was overruled by this court?
I do not. I think if this court wanted to overrule it, this court would have said, we overrule Sekula 1. That's done, as I cited in my brief, that's something that's done.
What was the holding in Sekula 1 by the Court of Appeals, as you see it?
Sekula 1, they found that the statute was constitutional, the language was in the statute was constitutional, the statute was valid, the reducing clause was valid. They then conducted what seems to be a contextual ambiguity type of analysis, looking at the declarations page, the type. I know paragraphs 12 through 15, they seem to be going that route. Then at the end of it, they simply said the one sentence I think issue was taken with, which was, once we have concluded the UIM provisions of a policy are unambiguous, as we have here, our inquiry is an end. And to me, it's not quite clear what they're deciding, because they're looking at the declarations page and the kind of things that you do in one of these contextual ambiguity things. But at the same time, the language there, I think, could be better worded. If you look at footnote 4 in Judge Denninger's dissent, my pronunciations are horrible. Denninger, sorry, that's not my district usually. If you look at paragraph 4 in that dissent, I think he really comments on that point very directly as to what Sekula 1 meant. You also look at the trial court's decision. And I think that the trial court was very concerned about that. The trial court didn't think there was an enormous shift there.
I have one other question. Are you, that is Heritage and Western, arguing the same points? And I'll listen to, of course, Western. And let me put it differently. Is it possible that by a particular decision of this court, one of you could succeed and the other not?
I have a hard time imagining that scenario.
You're both in the same boat.
To my mind, yes. That they perhaps have a little different position because I know they have a release and there was some money in exchange hands.
That's what I'm driving at.
I don't know how in the world that changes 80607 and the standard of review issue that's so important here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Ms. Davey?
May it please the Court? Counsel, my name is Nadine Davey, and I represent the defendant respondent petitioner, Western National Mutual Insurance Company. As the Court is well aware, there are really two primary issues here, and I think Justice Abrahamson's comments at the end in question to Attorney Simpson draws out those two issues. I'm here to comment on the second issue, but before I go into that argument, I feel compelled to respond to Justice Abraham's question as well. I would disagree with Attorney Simpson. I think that if this court, in my opinion, made an incorrect decision not to overrule 80607, the Court of Appeals decision with regard to 80607, that in fact you could rule in favor of Western National and determine that in fact the release prevents a application of 80607 and thereby allow for the case to terminate, if you will, with regard to Western National, because I think that they are two different issues. With that,
but you're not fighting about that. I mean,
no.
You've got, I think the Chief Justice's question was, maybe I mistook what the question was, you could come to different results, but the point is there's no dispute between the two of us.
There is absolutely no dispute between the two of us. It's just I have a different, Western National has a different issue. And with regard to that issue, it is our opinion that the trial court had never acquired at any point in time subject matter jurisdiction over the release. Subject matter jurisdiction in the state of Wisconsin is conferred under Wisconsin Statute Section 80104. And what that tells us is that subject matter jurisdiction is confirmed by statute and by constitution. And it cannot be waived, and it cannot be consented to. This case involved or was terminated by a voluntary dismissal under 80504. It was terminated with prejudice, and the stipulation and order did not provide for any type of continuing jurisdiction over the settlement which produced the stipulation and order for dismissal, in other words, the release. The release was never incorporated into the stipulation and order or the judgment of the court. The case law is clear that the court does not have continuing jurisdiction over an agreement for which the court has never taken any responsibility for which it has never approved, for which it never has been filed with the court, and in no way has, if you will, ever touched. The Supreme Court in the Kekkonen case at 511 U.S. 375 stated it, I think, well, the only order here was that the suit be dismissed. The court went on to state the situation would be quite different if the party's obligation to comply with the terms of the settlement agreement had been made a part of the order of dismissal, either by a separate provision retaining jurisdiction or by incorporating the terms of the settlement agreement in the order, neither of which were done in this case. The Sakalas are taking the position and asking this court to open something that the court had never even seen, never approved, never incorporated, or made part of the record. The Sakalas have asserted that the court has jurisdiction because the release is a stipulation under 80607. Why? Because 80705, it's asserted by the Sakalas that 80705 gives us the definition or defines a release as a stipulation. 80705 is not a definitional statute. It's not, and what illustrates that point is the first few words in that statute section, wherein the legislature says that a specifically distinguishes between an agreement, a stipulation, or a consent between parties, and it uses a disjunctive and appears to refer to those terms as mutually exclusive terms. Furthermore, case law supports the fact that that statute really is in the nature of a statute of frauds, designed to set forth minimum requirements for an agreement, a stipulation, or a consent. The purpose of that statute is to prevent disputes and uncertainties as to what is agreed upon. Yet the intent of the statute is to bind and not release. I would point out that the Sakalas themselves appear not to believe that stipulation equals release, because if you refer to the record, number 61, their notice of motion and motion for relief from judgment specifically states in the body of that document that they are requesting relief from all judgments, orders, releases, and stipulations. If, in fact, they truly believe that stipulations and releases were one and the same, why distinguish? They distinguish because they are different, and they're not defined under 80705. A release is a private agreement between parties. It's a contract. It has all the elements of a contract: offer, acceptance, a meeting of the minds, consideration. And it has, for time eternity, been interpreted as a contract, and when voided, contract law has applied. Contrary to the assertion made by the Court of Appeals, releases and stipulations are not commonly used to terminate litigation, That's a, if you will, somewhat elementary view. As lay people, our clients understand that if they sign a release, the case is completed. From a legal standpoint, nothing, if a release is not filed, which it wasn't in this case, there is nothing that terminates the litigation until the court is notified that the matter may be dismissed by typically filing a stipulation and an order to dismiss.
Without the release here. Without the release.
Without, in our case, without referring to the release. If, in fact, our stipulation and order had referred to the release, I think that 80607 would apply. I think the case law is clear that whenever you incorporate a release or a settlement agreement, or you, the court somehow takes responsibility for that agreement, that then 80607 applies.
So even though the release may be the basis for the stipulation and order for dismissal, it's your position, unless it's specifically referenced in the stipulation and or order, that the court doesn't have any kind of jurisdiction over the release. It's a private release.
Correct. It's a private contract.
Now, there's something intuitive to me that, you know, if this were a private release in the setting pre the filing of a complaint, you know, then, boy, you know, it's really private. But when, that is, there's no cause of action, isn't it? But when it is the basis of the stipulation and order for dismissal, now I'm talking about intuitive rather than citing you statute and case, that maybe the court should have jurisdiction, even if not incorporated. So tell me why I should not follow that path of intuition.
Because I think that what could happen is if you set a different standard for cases that are in litigation, just by virtue of the fact that they're in litigation, and give an opportunity for parties, if their case in litigation is in litigation, to reopen a case under 80607, what would stop either defendants or plaintiffs in an action from, for whatever reason, maybe settling a case before it's put into suit, or just put the case into suit, then settle your case, file a stipulation in order to dismiss, the court now has jurisdiction. There's no logical reason to set a distinction between releases reached during the course of litigation and those releases that are signed pre-litigation, except if the court takes some ownership or responsibility for that document. So that's the reason why we don't want to go down that path.
Don't you need the court consent to dismiss a case after an answer is filed?
Well,
I mean, there's a difference in the statutes. Pre-answer, the plaintiff really has a lot of control. In fact, can probably get it dismissed without prejudice unless somebody really objects to that and the court orders otherwise. But once that case has reached a particular stage, which is probably the answer, the plaintiff has lost control of it because it is now in the control of the court system. And if the court system says you can't dismiss, you can't dismiss. Isn't that right?
I guess I don't disagree. I'm thinking of if the parties agree, they settled the case, they said we've signed a settlement.
Then the court might say, I want to see that settlement. In fact, if it's a child, they have to see it. But want to see it because they might say, well, it's, want to see that it's settled fairly. This case is a case that involves issues that come up in hundreds of cases. And I think the settlement should be an open public record for purposes of this case and others. The court might be able to say that. I mean, we haven't litigated that kind of issue, right?
Correct. If the court then did that and wanted to embrace the release and the settlement, if it were, then it's going to fall into those line of cases where the court has taken some responsibility, as it should in the example you gave about a minor settlement.
Seems to me that any time a court signs a document, you have to say it has taken responsibility. I don't think you can let the court off the hook when it has potential discretion to say no. I mean, I'm not sure it has absolute discretion to say no, but let us suppose it does.
The release has a distinct and separate, it's a distinct and separate entity. And the concern I have about the path that the Court of Appeals is going down here is the public policy it's going to set, the constitutional infringement of the right of parties to contract, and the discouragement of settlements among parties. And those are the concerns that I think, those are the issues that I think this Court needs to be concerned about as well.
Now, just so I understand, the court might adopt your reasoning about release and hold in favor of Western on that basis and adopt Mr. Weiss's reasoning and hold against Heritage. Is that your position?
I think that that could occur, yes.
And if it doesn't, and the court says nothing about the distinction of release or doesn't buy your argument, then you're in the same boat as Heritage.
I am, Your Honor.
And you adopt his arguments.
Yes.
Is that right?
That is okay. Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Davey. Mr. Weiss? Now I know what the D stands for.
I was surprised to see that.
I was surprised too. I thought maybe there were two people here involved.
Good morning. I'm Jim Weiss, and I represent the Sukalas in this matter. Appreciate the opportunity to argue the case. I'd like to cover essentially four things if I could today. First, I think we should start with what the standard is and talk a little bit about the standard, because I think that largely that's been ignored in this process. Then I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of UIM, because I think that that is important in terms of what happened here. And I'd like to talk then a little bit about the errors that I feel that the trial court made, which caused the erroneous exercise of discretion. And I've got to get used to using that word as well, since all that case law refers to abuse. And then finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about finality, because I suspect that this court largely took this case because of concerns about the finality of judgments. And I believe that in the context of this case, that those concerns are grossly overestimated by my opponents here.
Counselor, let's start at the back instead of the front.
Okay.
Tell me about that. Why should we not be concerned about the finality of judgments?
Well, let me suggest a rule. And this morning, on my drive down from Rhinelander, I tried to formulate it because I've had some trouble doing that, that I would propose to the court, which I think would respect both the rights of someone like the Sukalas and give them the opportunity to present their case fully and to give them justice, which is the purpose of 80607 and particularly the purpose of the residual exception of 80607, and also ensure finality under these kinds of circumstances. And I guess I'll read to the court the rule, because I tried to draft it fairly precisely. I think that if the court adopted a rule that extraordinary circumstances exist when the court overrules, abrogates, or modifies by name a particular decision in a manner which clearly demonstrates that the litigant in that case may not have been accorded full justice, that such a rule would allow for people like the Sukalas, who are caught up in what is essentially an upheaval of new case law, to be able to present their matter when they're caught in unique circumstances, but by the same token, run no risk whatsoever that individuals would be bringing cases that under 80607 and trying to reopen those cases simply due to the evolution of case law.
Well, isn't case law always evolving? I mean, in the I've sat on the court for, this is my 13th year, and I have seen some of my well-written decisions go down the tube, so to speak. Not many, a couple, and have commented on that. But I think that out in, you know, when I was practicing, how do you advise people? What's so different about this case than any other case that in other areas that is involved, you know, shows an evolution? And the court changes, and there, but the finality would be, let's say, always in question then.
I agree, and I think that the courts, if the court has a concern about that, that is a very legitimate concern. But I think that the court can draft a rule. Obviously, 806.07.1H has to have some meaning. And in fact, the standard for 806.1H, which we keep, I think, letting slip in these kinds of circumstances, is that it's to be liberally construed to allow relief from judgments whenever appropriate to accomplish justice. It is appropriately used only when the circumstances are such that the sanctity of the final judgment is outweighed by the incessant command of the court's conscience that justice be done in light of all of the facts. So we start with the notion that we should liberally apply this statute to provide people like the Tsoukalas justice. So then your very legitimate question is, how can we make sure that that doesn't lead to people asking to reopen case simply because case law has evolved? And I think it's by doing it this way, Justice Wilcox, and that is by restricting the rule that says that extraordinary circumstances only exist when that case is specifically named. That case has to be specifically named, abrogated, modified, or overruled by the court in such a way so that the outcome of that case would be changed.
Counselor, why is someone whose case is specifically named to be given more, quote, justice, as you advise us, that's the purpose of the statute, than someone whose exact, precise issue is dealt with and overruled?
Well, I would not, extraordinary circumstances can occur in a whole variety of settings. And it's not impossible that you could have extraordinary circumstances in situations other than that. And a court would have to decide that on a case-by-case basis. But I think that if this court established a general rule that the case needs to be named, you restrict it substantially, you protect those people like the Tsoukalas who are essentially on the tip of the spear. I mean, one of the reasons that I want to talk a little bit today about the tortured history of UIM litigation is that I remember very graphically sitting down in the hospital in Minneapolis with the Tsoukalas shortly after John Tsoukala had been injured and saying to them in 1996, I have to tell you folks, I don't know where any of this is going. A little less than 6 months ago, the legislature passed a new statute that completely changes all of what has been the development of the law with respect to the most important issues in your case, uninsured motorist coverage. And I can tell you folks right now that your case may end up in the Supreme Court because it's clearly going to be one of the very early cases in this regard. And so the Tsoukalas, being on the tip of that spear, go through this. And as they go through it, we can see from the tortured history here, that things change with respect to the case law as we're going through it, but the Tsoukalas are in the lead, and very appropriately, and I'm not critical of either the courts of appeals nor the Supreme Court, there are a variety of inconsistent decisions at the trial court level, at the court of appeals level, that are taking place, and the Tsoukalas are in the lead of this. One of the purposes of 806.07, I believe, 1H, is to clearly protect them when they are on the tip of the spear like this, so that when the case law does settle down and it's clear that an injustice has been done to them specifically, that they have the opportunity to redress that.
Mr. Weiss, if I can follow up Justice Rogensack's question, what really makes their situation any different than another plaintiff in exactly the same situation who had the same type of case go through the system, who lost while this case was evolving? but wasn't mentioned by the Supreme Court in an opinion questioning or reversing or modifying a court of appeals decision. What's the distinction between the two?
Well, I think that, number one, it's very difficult, unless the case is specifically named, for us to say that the issue would have been identical. There are some circumstances in which we might be able to say those, but say that, but that situation would be extraordinarily rare. If we limit the rule to having the case named, then we know that the specific issue that we're dealing with as of 80607 is the issue that's before the court. That's obviously exactly what happened in Sukala. I mean, clearly what happened in Sukala, and one of the things that I think the trial court judge did wrong here is he just didn't read Badger Mutual correctly at all. Because I think that any kind of a fair reading of Badger Mutual is that while Sukala was not overruled, because it couldn't be overruled, as far as Sukala went, it was correct. The problem with Sukala is it didn't finish the second part of the analysis under Dauhauer, and so that was the problem with Sukala. They did the first part of the analysis and did that part of the analysis correctly.
What's the first part?
The first part was in taking a look at the reducing clause and determining that the reducing clause was unambiguous. And this court in Badger Mutual and in Folkman and all the progeny since the time of Sukala 1 has said that that analysis is absolutely correct, that you take a look at it, and we've never challenged the fact that the reducing clause was unambiguous. The problem is that the court then concluded and said so explicitly that once we find that that reducing clause is unambiguous, the inquiry ends. The inquiry ends. And this court in Badger Mutual said that is not correct because you can have a unambiguous reducing clause and have other provisions of the policy that when you look at it altogether with there can be contextual ambiguity that can render the policy something that a reasonable insured does not understand. And there was a crystal clarity rule that came out of Badger Mutual, which was subsequently modified somewhat. I shouldn't say modified. The court clarified it in Folkman by saying crystal clarity doesn't mean that there can't be any ambiguity, but what it does mean is that a reasonable insured has to be able to read the policy and understand the policy, and the reasonable insured rule has continued throughout Badger Mutual and through Folkman. Part of the problem with the court's decision in this case, if you take a look at the very end of the transcript, and it's the transcript of the court proceedings, pages basically 42 through 45, what you'll see is that Judge Fleshhauer was having trouble understanding Badger Mutual and its implications with respect to Sukala. And in fact, Judge Fleshhauer, in that part of his decision, said, I don't really think that Sukala was overruled. And essentially, he said, I don't think that the outcome of Sukala would have been different given Badger Mutual. And we had this colloquy then about the section of Badger Mutual in which Justice Bradley's dissent in the Taylor case, in which Justice Bradley says, an unambiguous reducing clause might be ambiguous within the context of the whole policy and that the standard should be that of a reasonable insured. That section was adopted by the court explicitly in Badger Mutual. And Judge Fleshhauer and I had colloquy about that, but Judge Fleshhauer said, well, I'm not really certain that they're really adopting a reasonable man standard, and if I'm wrong about that, then, you know, perhaps we need to revisit this issue. Well, Judge Fleshhauer was wrong about that. In both Badger Mutual and subsequently in Folkman, the court has made it very clear that a reasonable insured standard is the standard to be applied, and that standard was never applied to the Sukalas. Ultimately, what happened to the Sukalas is that they only were given half a loaf. They were given the opportunity to talk about whether or not the reducing clause was ambiguous or unambiguous. That decision was made against them, but they were never given the opportunity to take a look at this whole policy And with all due respect to my colleague here, Mr. Simpson, it does matter. And the reason that it does matter is that the, and I hope I won't be struck down by lightning, but he had brought up the Pope decision, which he had brought up the Pope decision, which is an unpublished decision, and I know that we can't cite unpublished decisions to the court, but that is a very, very different policy than the policy in this case. The court needs to recall in this case that this accident happens in 1996. This policy drafted immediately after the time of the legislation. The policy was a commercial policy, Heritage's, which covered Haseley and Haseley, the employer for Mr. Sukala, and it is a long, convoluted, complicated policy. Now, it may well be that the reducing clause, the unambiguous reducing clause, might be identical to that of the Pope case. Frankly, I've not compared them, but the reducing clauses may be identical. The policies are anything but identical. And I can assure the court that I would not be here wasting my breath if I felt that there was not a good opportunity to convince the trial court and any subsequent court of appeals in this matter that given the nature of the Heritage policy here, that there is contextual ambiguity. And if there is, that would mean approximately $900,000, if my math is right, more to my client, who was very, very severely injured.
Mr. Weiss, in Sukala 1, what were you arguing to the Court of Appeals?
Sukala 1 was very interesting, Justice Prosser, because if you looked at this record, you would kind of think that the illusory and ambiguity argument was not a part of the case originally. But the history of this is that we had made a constitutional challenge with respect to the application of the statute, and the gravamen of the constitutional challenge was twofold. Essentially, it was that because this court had consistently said that these provisions were illusory and were mere fraudulent, that on a substantive due process basis, the legislature could not ratify that kind of conduct. So there was a substantive due process argument based upon the illusory and ambiguous nature of the contracts, given the prior case law. There was also a separation of powers argument that was made based upon the Constitution. And my expectation at that time was that the court would either say, yes, we found these things to be illusory and ambiguous, therefore the legislature could not pass a bill validating them, or they would say they are constitutional and they're all right. In fact, I was surprised by the Dauhauer decision in which the court said, no, it is constitutional to have these reducing clauses and the legislation is constitutional. However, even though it's constitutional, doesn't mean that it's necessarily enforceable because it can still be illusory and ambiguous. When that occurred then, and the appeal was pending before the Madison District of the court, then we had to consult with the court about what we were going to talk about because the constitutionality had been upheld. But there were these new issues that changed the illusory ambiguity argument that had been raised only in the constitutional context. So once we got to oral argument, we did argue the ambiguous, illusory nature of the contract. The court allowed us to do that. We had suggested that we give supplementary briefs on that issue since Dauhauer was brand new and at the time. But the court declined to do that, listened to our oral argument, and then made the decision. I hope that that's responsive to your question, Justice Prosser.
But basically, you did argue contextual ambiguity at some point, orally.
Absolutely. And then the result of that was that the court ended up coming up with a decision that said, we find that the reducing clause that you guys are arguing about is unambiguous, and once we find that, it's constitutional. And it can't be illusory because our inquiry ends once we find it's unambiguous. Then we petitioned for review to this court This court denied our petition for review, and very shortly thereafter then, you know, accepted the Badger Mutual case, in which the court said, no, it's not enough to find it unambiguous. And that's why those are the unique set of circumstances that I think are clearly extraordinary circumstances. And they really happened not through a fault of this court or through the appellate court or, frankly, of the Tsoukalas or Heritage or Western, for that matter. They happened because it's a very natural thing when a statute changes and that statute involves a controversial area of the law, it takes a little bit of time for that law to settle out. And the true fact of the matter here is that the Tsoukalas are victims because they were on the tip of the spear. If they had been slightly back of the spear, they'd have been all right. But
could I just ask you, on your formulation, I think you've already conceded that the Schmitz case did not overrule Tsoukala 1.
I think that the term, if you take a look in Shepherd's, Shepherd's will say that it's been abrogated. I think that the practical effect, regardless of what we call it, is that Tsoukala 1 was clearly affirmed in part. No question about that. Tsoukala 1 was also overruled, not in terms of the decision, but in terms of their failure to complete the analysis. And I don't know, and certainly the court knows better than I do, but it seems to me that under those circumstances, it probably isn't proper to say that the case has been overruled, because since there wasn't an analysis performed by the Court of Appeals on that issue, we don't know what that analysis would have been, and there was nothing to formally overrule on that end of it. So the court appropriately said,
Mr. Weiss, isn't there a chilling effect on members of the court if they critique anything in a Court of Appeals decision? We might run the risk of abrogating it, even though we don't say that, and the West Publishing Company comes out and uses that term?
Well, if the question essentially is there a risk if the court critiques a decision that is a very young decision, which is certainly the situation in this case, and explicitly critiques that decision by name and says that a part of the analysis was wrong, is that something that could prompt an 80607 motion? Yes, I think it could, and I think that it should. Again, 80607 is designed to make sure that we allow for justice, makes sure that we allow for individuals that may be caught up in quickly evolving turbulent case law to be able to get justice. I think that possibility exists. But I think that's exactly the purpose of 80607. There are very, very rare circumstances, and the proof of the pudding in that regard, for instance, is that with Tsoukala, once I read Badger Mutual, I and my law firm had many, many reducing clause cases that arguably would have been affected by Tsoukala. There wasn't a single motion under 80607 on any of those cases to reopen those cases based upon Badger Mutual, because I don't believe that the extraordinary circumstances of the kind that were apparent in Mullen and are also apparent in Tsoukala were apparent there.
Mr. Weiss, what do you think the difference is between overruling, abrogating, or modifying? Do you think there's any real difference in those terms?
Well, I think there is a difference, but I don't think that difference matters here. And here's why I say that, Justice Crooks. What we're getting at in 80607 is whether or not the Tsoukalas got a fair deal. And whether we call the Badger Mutual criticism of Tsoukala overruling, whether we call it modifying, or whether we call it abrogating, the substance of it is that the analysis wasn't completed in the appellate court decision or by anyone else for that matter. So substantively, I don't think it matters what we call it, because 80607 essentially invokes the inherent equitable powers of the court. We are talking here about what is fair. what is fair and what is right, and we're to liberally construe that to give the Tsoukalas their opportunity in court. So a technical analysis of whether or not it's overruled, modified, or abrogated, I don't think it matters if substantively we agree that the analysis was not performed.
Under 806.07.1H, there's a requirement of action being taken within a reasonable period of time. Do you feel that that was done here, that you brought your motion within a reasonable period of time?
Absolutely. I believe that, I apologize for the quote, but I would imagine that the record would show it. I know that this was argued in the early fall, given Judge Fleshauer's schedule, the schedule of the lawyers involved, which was Ms. Davey and I believe John Kramer was involved in that argument as well. The typical time to schedule the hearing, get it briefed and schedule the hearing, is at least a couple of months. I think the court will find that the motion was filed very promptly after we digested Badger Mutual. And again, in terms of formulating this rule that I had proposed earlier, one of the things that I've struggled with, and if the court adopts my position, I guess I kind of leave it to the court, is that there obviously should be some requirement that this be done promptly. Now, if there is a 20-year-old decision that is named and criticized, I don't think that an 806.07 motion is proper. And I think that it would be denied by virtually any court. Now, here, the timing is such that obviously the problem is that the Tsoukalas were on the tip of the spear, very similar to Mullen. You know, Mullen, we do have this period of time that actually overlapped, but substantively, I don't think it matters. Both of them were involved in litigation that was turbulent, and both of them had taken the same position. So I think equitably, these cases are really very similar.
Counsel, that's the area that concerns me, this timing and the overlapping. As I look at Mullen, there's overlapping. I've written a couple of cases, Brown versus Bradley, no relation, and Harmon versus Hadley, that have the same kind of situation we're talking about here, where maybe a petition for review and one was granted and the other one was denied. But in all of the cases that I've seen, there has been some overlapping. And here you're not asking for overlapping. To me, this is a leap. So do you know of any case where there has not been overlapping, but because we have changed the law, we allow it to extend to a case that had been finished, final, with no overlapping?
I may be wrong about this, but I think that almost the entire panoply of cases that involve an overlapping issue would be Mullen under...
Well, it's in the criminal context, State versus Brown, rather Brown versus Bradley, Harmon versus Hadley, and that I can't remember exactly. I think it was some kind of a... that was written by the chief. Brown was written by me, you know, and that's asking for a petition for review. And in some of these cases have been what I call Schmelzer-like cases, which is another case where prisoners wanted to have something litigated. You know, so it's not in the civil context, but it's in the criminal context or quasi-criminal context where we've had this. And it's always been, not always, in the few examples, it's been overlapping.
I guess my response is simply this, and that is that 806.07, sub 1, sub 8, in fact, 806.07, generally invokes the equitable power of the court. And for instance, let's change the facts here a little bit, and let's say that the difference is one day rather than 7 months. And then let's take it and make it one day after so that we have a one-day overlap. From an equitable point of view, it strikes me that that really shouldn't be determinative. The question is whether or not whether or not, from an equitable point of view, from a fundamental fairness point of view, these people have been wronged. And certainly at some time limit, the court might say, had the court in this case, for instance, I would have had much less trouble with a decision by Judge Fleshauer. If Judge Fleshauer had said, no, I think 7 months is too long, I would have had much less trouble with that, disagreed with it, but had much less trouble with that than his ultimate decision, which was, I don't think I've got the authority to do this, because he misconstrued Mullen and he misconstrued Badger Mutual. And because of that, he felt his hands were tied and that he couldn't do that. So he erroneously read this case law and then couldn't exercise his discretion. I think that we can trust and should trust. 80607 has a purpose. It is designed, I believe, exactly for these kinds of circumstances to make sure that people can have justice. Most of you were trial court judges before you came on the bench. I think that we can trust the good sense of our trial court judges to balance the equities and to balance those equities properly in order to make decisions. And I think it's very, very unlikely that, for instance, in cases, well, it has been, it's been virtually non-existent so far, in cases where it's just been a matter of evolving law, judges haven't reopened them at the trial court, and then the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have not sustained that. And so I don't think that there's really any real concern that this is in any way going to open the floodgates. Judges are going to be very careful, and the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court will be appropriate gatekeepers.
But I'm just thinking about your time lapse limitations. Now, Judge Fleischauer didn't say that, but I think if this court, you don't think there's going to be any repercussions. We're looking at here at an insurance case, but certainly this could apply to many different areas of the law. And I'm still, the standard you seem to be saying is one of fundamental fairness, and there has to be some close proximity in time. But beyond that, anything else?
Well, I've tried to think, Justice Wilcox, to be honest with you, of because I thought about a two-part rule. The first thing that I proposed, and then some rule on timing. I've struggled more with the issue of timing. And you folks are certainly more experienced in these matters than I am, and I leave it to your good judgment in that regard. However, if the court didn't say anything in that matter and merely used the term close proximity, I have very little fear that trial courts, because they respect finality of judgments, are going to willy-nilly reopen cases under 80607. I think that it would be very difficult. I don't even think practitioners would often bring those motions, certainly not in situations where it's just a matter of evolving case law. It hasn't happened much in the past. If we look at the panoply of cases under 80607, there aren't many of them over the time that it's existed. Courts have been careful. Litigants have been careful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Mr. Simpson, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. One thing Mr. Weiss said that stuck with me, and I wrote it down, we can trust the good sense of our trial judges. That's what this case is really about. Where was there an improper exercise of discretion? I've heard there's some disagreement. Maybe the judge could have reached a different decision type talk, but I've seen nothing from the Court of Appeals. I've seen nothing by way of argument or briefing that this was a failure to exercise discretion. That's what the standard is. What we're asking for is an opinion applying that standard, and that concludes this case because the trial judge did exercise discretion. That's the first point I'd like to make. Second point I'd like to make relates to Mr. Weiss's proposed standard that if you happen to be lucky enough to get your name listed in a subsequent decision, whether it's modifying, abrogating, or overruling, or whatever other descriptive term you would choose to use, that gives you the right to start over again. What if I'm litigating and I have an unpublished opinion in the Court of Appeals that nobody's ever going to cite again? Gee, I guess that's not. I guess I'm out of luck because my opinion isn't going to be cited by anybody in the future. It's the nature of the appellate system that we have this type of a problem occurring, and it's something you have to deal with. It's very arbitrary to say, gee, if you're lucky enough to get your case mentioned, whatever the mention is made of it, you can have a chance to relitigate. That creates a lot of uncertainty for litigants. And I think Justice Prosser raises a valid point when he says there's a chilling effect on what you write when you're going to realize that that's what ultimately may occur from that. The final point I'd like to make relates to a couple of things Mr. Weiss has said. I think Mr. Weiss has the same problem that I suffer from frequently, also known as tunnel vision, or tunnel vision toward your client. I've heard him refer to, what's this case about justice for the Sakalas? I heard him refer frequently, the Sakalas are on the tip of a spear. Well, it's in all deference to Mr. Weiss and the Sakalas, it's about justice for litigants in the state of Wisconsin. Litigants on both sides of the case, in this case and other cases, and what standard are we going to use? And that's my, sorry, I'm over my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Ms. Davey?
I'm going to just respond briefly also to a couple of the remarks that Mr. Weiss made with regard to justice. And I did pick up on the same points that Attorney Simpson did. I think that one of the things I heard Mr. Weiss talk about is that clearly there's been an injustice that has been done to the Sakalas because of the way in which the cases were handled, the petition for review denied. I don't think that it's clear that in this case there's been an injustice done to the Sakalas. And I agree with Mr. Simpson's comments that this is a global justice for all litigants, whether we're talking about insurance companies or we're talking about individuals. I also disagree with Mr. Weiss his comments concerning the trial court's reading of Badger. I think the trial court was struggling. I think it's that the judge was attempting to get his hands around that decision. But I think he understood it, and I think he applied it. And I disagree that in Sakala 1 that the court didn't complete its analysis. I think there are paragraphs in that decision in which, even though the court said the analysis ends here, they went on to analyze the policy language in its entirety, the UIM provisions, the reducing clause, and took a look at the policy as a whole. They didn't take pages and pages and paragraphs to do that, but they did analyze it. And that issue was an issue that was that all parties had an opportunity to argue at the time that oral argument was heard in the earlier Sakala 1 case. I think this case is all about finality of judgments, not only finality as it relates to 80607, but finality as it relates to releases and private party agreements that parties to a lawsuit or not enter into, and protecting the finality of lawsuits and, in particular, in relationship to the Western National issue, protection of private party agreements and allowing those agreements to stand. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Davey. Thank you, Mr. Simpson. Thank you, Mr. Weiss, for your excellent arguments on finality and opening up judgments. That concludes our hearing on 03-0173, Sakala versus Heritage Mutual Insurance Company et al. The court is in recess until 1:30. Anyone who wishes to remain listen to the discussion of the court's procedures with Justice Crooks may do so. See you at 1:30.